Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market. I'm your guest host, Drew Yelm, sitting in for Radio Free Market founder, Mike McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Also with me today is my co-host, Aaron Brown. Welcome to the show, Aaron.
Glad to be here, Drew.
So today's topic is grappling with greenbackers. And Aaron, could you kind of expand on the topic? Because it sounds kind of, it's a kind of a broad topic.
Yeah, it's a broad topic, but it's I'm really glad we get to do this for our listeners, because I kind of wrote in an article I wrote a while ago that this is really the next monster that we have to tackle after we get rid of kind of the whole Keynesian mess. I think greenbackism is really the next big problem we have to deal with. And greenbackism, it was the idea is that instead of having the private central bank control the currency, and that private central bank charges the government interest, so that people are getting, you know, just robbed by these interest-bearing loans that they're creating out of thin air, which is bad. It's true that it's bad that we have these loans being made out of thin air, and then we get charged interest on them. But greenbackers propose that we give the complete monopoly control over money to the Treasury, and abolishing the middleman, the central bank. And it has its roots in the green currency that Abraham Lincoln used to finance the Northern invasion of the South in the Civil War.
So yeah, I remember reading in a couple of different sources about the Civil War. It's really interesting what exactly happened. I mean, so between roughly the 1830s, 1836 or so, to the 1862, you had the quote-unquote free banking era, close to 1840. Yeah, this free banking era where basically there's no national control of banks. It was all state control, more or less. And it wasn't free per se. Like, there was still tons of regulations on the banks. There's never been a point in time in U.S. history that there has been a quote unquote, 100% free market in banking. But in particular, the free banking era was the most lenient of those times. But, starting the Civil War, in order to finance the Civil War, the Congress passed the National Banking Act in 1862, which was to make banks nationally chartered, so that they would have to take on government debt in order to finance the Civil War. But that didn't work out so well, because these banks didn't want to take on the debt, because they were good to go with just staying with their current as a state chartered bank. So they created the Legal Tender Act in 1862, right after the National Banking Act, which put a 10% tax, I believe, a 10% tax
on the state bank, on a state banks to drive them out of existence.
Right, and it did their job. It did exactly what it was meant to do. It forced all these banks to become nationally chartered, and so that was the end of the quote unquote free banking era, which lasts. And so then you had this national banking era, which lasted from, well, it. It changed course in 1872, 1873, when they started getting rid of the greenbacks for good. But we'll talk about this more a little bit, obviously. But there was a lot of damage that was caused specifically by the currency.
Yeah, in preparation for the show, I didn't even know this before researching this, is that we kind of always hear from greenback proponents that, oh, you know, Lincoln, you know, you can refer to the Radio Free Market archives if you haven't had the myth of Lincoln dispelled. But Lincoln didn't like greenbacks. He didn't like them. Don't know why, but just when you watch what he did, and not what he says, he signed the charter for the greenbacks. For the issuance. But after the second time he signed a bill that would issue greenbacks, he wanted to stop, and he started to endorse the National Bank Act. And we'll get into this a little more in the next segment, and we'll see how truly corrupt Lincoln was.
Yeah, we're gonna have to get pretty close to the next segment here, about 15 seconds left. So, but after the break, we're gonna talk more with Aaron Brown about the history of the greenback movement here on Radio Free Market. So please stay tuned. We'll be back shortly. All right. So, Welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm your guest host, Drew Yelm. With me is Aaron Brown, and we're talking about grappling with greenbackers today. And one of the points I kind of wanted to go back to that we were talking about last segment was this, with Lincoln. So what you're saying is that the greenbackers say that Lincoln supported the greenbacks or that he opposed? I guess I didn't really kind of catch that part.
Yeah, I think it kind of ties in with this, the modern myth that Lincoln was this great liberty advocate, you know, that Lincoln is just one of the greatest presidents we ever have. And of course, that means that everything Lincoln ever did was for the good of the people. And so greenbackers try to say, because Lincoln was this great god, which he was not, but let's just say he was, this is what greenbackers say, because Lincoln was this great man, everything he did must have been for the good of the common man. So because he presided over an administration in which they printed greenbacks, that must have been a good thing. That must have been for the people. When in fact, you know, you hear in, you can go back to these Thomas DiLorenzo articles we've done, and one of the things he points out is that Lincoln said himself what his policies were. He never said, I'm in favor of greenback. I'm in favor of Treasury having monopoly control of the money. Lincoln said, quote, you know, my politics are short and sweet like the old woman's dance. I'm in favor of a national bank, in favor of the internal improvement system and a high productive tariff, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah,
but he was in favor of a national bank.
Yeah, and I mean, because it makes, I mean, because from what I understand of Lincoln and just in general, Whig / Republican party politics of the early, mid 19th century is that they wanted these national banks. They wanted a national bank to help business, like, you know, help northern interests. They wanted protective tariffs to help northern industry, and they wanted internal improvements and high tariffs to pay for all this. They wanted these high tariffs to pay for these internal improvements. So I guess it really doesn't surprise me Lincoln's motivation, especially considering, you know, his backing or his previous experience as one of the foremost railroad lawyers in the country.
Yeah, and I don't, you know, this is relatively new information I found that, you know, that Lincoln, he was in favor of the national bank over the central, over the treasury control, and I can only really, really speculate, other than for the political reasons that he wanted to, you know, tie the money class to the government. And maybe he thought that if you know, if Congress had control of the Treasury, that would sort of alienate the moneyed class. And this is what, you know, Lincoln says this in his own writings. We know that he wanted to tie the, you know, the moneyed class to the government. So that's something that was very interesting to me too. That because it would seem that if you were in favor of internal improvements and a high tariff, it is kind of strange to me that you need this second level, this central bank concept. So that's something that I would still like to explore in another interview on greenbackism, because this is certainly not a one show topic. This is an incredibly broad, I mean, this myth of greenbackism has been a plague on, you know, the free market kind of advocates. You know, it's snuck into kind of fiscal conservative circles where you're either an Austrian or you're kind of a monetarist greenbacker. It's kind of odd.
And one of the things, you know, it's kind of interesting that, you know, we're talking about Lincoln in this context because, and then I've also read that Ellen Brown, who's one of the predominant greenbackers, she kind of advocated the idea of greenbackism in the context of It worked so well in Nazi Germany as well.
Oh, yeah.
And well, yes. So it's funny too, because so you've got her advocating, you know, greenbackism in Nazi Germany, which there's a fantastic book called Wages of Destruction by Adam Tooze, where he goes into the Nazi economy and how it actually didn't actually work all that well, or it just kind of, you know, explains just, you know, basically the Nazi economy just functioned first and foremost for the production of war goods for the state, with people at the distant second. And so that's one of her examples. Another one of her examples is obviously the Civil War greenback era. And so it seems to me that a lot of this whole greenbackism and giving money, the money power to the state, it always goes back to this idea that the government needs the power of money to go to war.
Yeah, and how, I mean, and she doesn't advocate the war part, but everything else she advocates, and she points out the Civil War as evidence that greenbackism worked. First of all, I mean, you can find this. This is public knowledge anywhere, which is what surprised me, that anyone could have the position that she holds, because it's public knowledge. Prices went up by 75% during the Civil War. So I don't know if, you know, how you can defend that this is a good system because prices almost doubled.
Well, I guess, like you said earlier, the theory behind greenbackism is rather than having a central bank issue the money at interest to the government, then the government can just create the money by itself and not pay interest.
You know, I wonder is maybe that Lincoln, being as obviously business savvy as he was, understanding the mercantilist system and how it functions and how it enriches the political class and the elites, if he understood, because that with a greenbacker type of scheme, I mean, look, in 2 years that greenbackers were issued, prices went up 75%. I mean, at least with the central bank, it seems like there are mechanisms to hide the inflation. But if the government's just printing up interest-free money, then it seems like the monetary veil just wears off very quickly. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well,
because the inflation just becomes apparent very, very quickly. Maybe perhaps because the Treasury isn't compensated by interest. I wonder if that has something to do with if that's one of the reasons that the inflation shows up a lot quicker.
Well, there could be a nominal change, because I mean, if you just, you know, go back to basic interest calculation, real interest is the rate of return minus the nominal interest rate, right?
Mm-hmm.
With that in mind, if you're increasing the money supply, without having to pay interest, you're going to have much more tolerance, or much more of a greater threshold to increase the money supply, because you're not paying that interest.
Yeah, and you know, and another thing about her example, Ellen Brown. This is Ellen Brown, but this could be any greenbacker, because she's a very good representative for greenbackism. So we could just say that greenbacker's argument for the greenbacker system and how well it worked during the Civil War. You've also got to look at what was happening on the other side. Who was the North fighting during that time? They were fighting the Confederacy, and the Confederacy, that's also an interesting story. The Confederacy ultimately failed because they centrally planned the economy, and they had something like 3,500% inflation. So, you know, it's the North had a much more sophisticated system, a much more integrated market. That is why. That's probably why they didn't have as much inflation as the Confederacy did. But either way, greenbackers never point out that prices nearly doubled during the Civil War. I still don't understand how that's a tenable position. You know what else is, I found out just from researching for the show, is that greenbackers never really mention if Lincoln is this great guy. They focus on this 3 or 4 year period of history in which the Treasury was issuing greenbacks, and they say, oh, Lincoln is this great guy. Look, he did this greenback, interest-free printing of money. Look at what Lincoln did the day after he was inaugurated. In 1861, he appointed his political rival to be Secretary of the Treasury, Salmon P. Chase. Salmon Chase was a close friend of a man named Jay Cook, who helped to get Chase elected. Once Chase got elected, Jay Cook set up an investment banking company. Then what did Chase do? He granted Jay Cook and Company a monopoly over the sale of U.S. government bonds. So you look at this and you say, what is going on here? This is, how can this be good for the common people? It's such an untenable position, and there's no way to defend it. So what do greenbackers do? They ignore it completely.
Well, and it's really interesting too. Well, you know, the mercantile the whole idea of mercantilism is definitely not alien to discuss. Well, for most people, including the Greenbacks, it probably is. But the whole idea of mercantilism is definitely not alien to the discussion of Abraham Lincoln. And in particular, when you're talking about Jay Cook and you're talking about all these Wall Street people, one of the things that that people don't really realize about investment banking is that prior to the 1930s, investment banking, the only thing that pretty much investment banks invested in prior to the 1930s was government debt. That was the whole idea of central banking and central banking government finance from the end of the Revolutionary War, first Bank of the United States, all the way through up until the passage and the creation of Freddie Mae or Fannie Mae in 1937, was the idea of a way to fund government through these investment banks. It wasn't until the 1930s that then it branched out to the government subsidizing housing, and then housing becoming another major investment. It was actually also railroads in the 1800s too that mm-hmm. became another major investment, these investment houses, which obviously one of the things that people don't realize is that all these railroads are also subsidized by the government as well.
Mm. So, I hope by this point our listeners are, you have another, hopefully you've listened to our past shows on Lincoln, but hopefully at this point we've dispelled another myth that you might have heard about Lincoln as, you know, that he's a heroic opponent of the bankers and big government tyranny and centralized power. Lincoln made the big bankers even richer by consolidating monetary power in the central government, and we can talk a little more about that after the break. We're coming up close to the end of this segment. Stay with us on Radio Free Market. We're talking about greenbackism with me, Aaron Brown, and Drew Yelm. Stay with us.
And welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm your guest host, Drew Yelm. My co-host today is Aaron Brown, and we're talking about greenbacks. Specifically, we're grappling with it. We're grappling with greenbacks today. And before the break, we were talking a bit about the history of the greenback movement. But I think, you know, now it's time to more gear towards the present. And in particular, you know, we're always, you know, they, I was listening to Judge Napolitano last night, or Freedom Watch, and they had a segment off Ron Paul where he was talking about, you know, returning to the gold standard, or at least competing currencies and getting the Fed out of monetary system. And then you had Dennis Kucinich on right afterward, who, you know, he has a lot of good sentiments, but specifically he's kind of a greenbacker himself. He wants to get rid of the Fed, and he wants to, you know, so we don't have to pay interest to the Federal Reserve to create money. But I guess, is there a problem with the idea that, you know, you need to pick one or the other, have the Fed create the money with interest or the government create the money without interest?
It seems like those are kind of like Tom Wood says, your choices between, what was it, Rush Limbaugh and Nancy Pelosi or something like that. He said, you know, your choices are between this and this, citizen. And it seems like the choices we're presented with is either Congress has the monopoly power, or this supposedly independent private central bank has the power. But it's just totally misleading, because to say that the Federal Reserve is qualitatively different from having Treasury have the monopoly control over the money, it's just false. I mean, you wouldn't say that, you know, the Department of Homeland Security is a private institution. You know, if you take a bunch of security firms and then pass, you know, have Congress pass a law to make those private security firms into the Department of Homeland Security, you wouldn't say that's private. And in the same way, if you cartelize, if you make the banks into a cartel by passing a bill that allows them to be protected by the government, that ceases to be a private consortium of banks. So to say that the Federal Reserve is private is just completely false. And that's the big problem. With, you know, if you watch, there's a documentary called Money Masters, which I know Drew has seen. If you want to watch it, it's free online.
Well, yeah, but Money Masters is produced by greenbackers.
Absolutely, because they have this idea that because the private so-called banks, even though they're protected by the government and the Federal Reserve was created by an act of Congress, how can you say that as a private bank? It's completely, it seems like it's just, I don't know why that's so hard to understand. When, you know, if McDonald's was brought into existence by an act of Congress, you know, the McDonald's Act of 1954, you know, you wouldn't say McDonald's is a private institution anymore because it was created by an act of Congress.
Well, so I think what they're trying to say, and it's just a point of confusion, but what they're trying to say is that since, okay, so the Federal Reserve was created by an act of Congress, then it's a, you know, the Federal Reserve Board is appointed by the government, but then each of the 12 Federal Reserve district banks or the Federal Reserve banks, they're actually owned by the banks in their district, right? So yeah. they're trying to say that these banks then take profits from whatever operations the Fed does, but that's actually not even true because all profits that the Federal Reserve makes are sent back to the Treasury. So I don't
exactly. The Federal Reserve is just an arm of the Treasury, like you said. That's how it should be viewed, instead of the Federal Reserve is this kind of alien private central bank out there somewhere. It's just an arm of the Treasury. That's what it really is.
I mean, that's not to say it's not a bad thing. It's a horrible thing, but
absolutely,
their entire thing that, you know, the government lends money out, the government borrows money at interest and has to pay all this interest to the Federal Reserve to create money and this, that, and other thing. It's really not, it's a weird convolution that the greenbackers have put together in their minds.
Yeah, and you know, and greenbackers, I've had, you know, I went down to Occupy LA, Occupy Los Angeles, many times, and people who had this greenback idea in their heads, they're very open to it because they understand it's a fraudulent system that we have. But I think one of the other ideas that we'll talk about later in the show is this never-ending faith in government. You know, the Federal Reserve is private, and so we have no control over it. But if Congress had control over it, then we have control over our representatives, and therefore we have control of the money. And so it kind of ties back to this never-ending, you know, this faith that, oh, this small group of people, if we just put the power in their hands, because they're our elected representatives, and because they're going to do it with good faith, as if money printing with good faith is somehow going to be qualitatively different than, you know, money printing in bad faith.
Yeah, we'll definitely cover this topic again, but, you know, people with a state mindset, they have this belief that good intentions necessarily leads to good results.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the bottom line of that whole, we have about a minute left in this segment, but what we want you to take away from this segment is that the Fed is not private. So it's somewhat of a mistake to say that Congress doesn't already have control of the money. So there's this belief that if we go back to the Treasury and Congress having control of the money, that'll be better, when they really already do. They could abolish the Federal Reserve at any point.
Yeah, the Fed's not independent. You know, I mean, we can talk more about this after the break, but the Fed works in tandem. Ben Bernanke and Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama or George Bush, they all like skip up and down Maiden Lane hand in hand, whistling Dixie. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah. So, you know, and we're going to talk about this more after the break. Unfortunately, we're coming close to the end of the segment. So stay with me and Drew Yelm on Radio Free Market. We'll be back talking about the myths of greenbackism. All right. Thank you. And stay with us.
And welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm your guest host, Drew Yelm. My co-host today is Aaron Brown. And we are grappling with greenbackers. You know, during the break, so earlier in the show, we were talking about Jay Cook. We were talking about national banking and everything. And I just tried to Google Jay Cook, and I went to Wikipedia, but Wikipedia is blacked out today, so I can't look him up. But
that was, you know, a real problem for me today.
I felt so alone. I can't do anything today because there's, you know, because of all this blackout stuff. But, you know, it's really interesting. Like, what I found fascinating is this idea that the Federal Reserve is a private, like, you know, this idea that the Federal Reserve is a private bank and it acts completely independently of the government. There's a really fascinating book. It's by this economist named Robert Auerbach. It's called Deception and Abuse of the Fed. And it talks a lot about Greenspan. But one of the more interesting anecdotes in the book is like during the 70s, specifically 1972, Arthur Burns was the chairman of the Fed. Now, if you don't know who Arthur Burns is, he makes Alan Greenspan. He makes Alan Greenspan look like John the Baptist in terms of, like, honesty. Arthur Burns is just a horrible person. But in particular, like, he was an appointee, a lifelong Republican, and an appointee of Richard Nixon to the Federal Reserve, to be the Federal Reserve chairman. And what he did was specifically during 1972 was to decrease the interest rate specifically so that it would create a short-run boom to get Nixon reelected. So you had the short-run boom created just to get Nixon reelected, acting in tandem with the government. It's not independent at all. So I thought that was funny. But in particular, so we were talking a little. We kind of wanted to get more into the idea of, you know, what's going on behind the scenes here. You know, what's the raw mechanisms involved with central banking and specifically government planning. And I guess it kind of falls down. It always falls back to F.A. Hayek, Mises, the knowledge problem, economic calculation problem, whatever is your most preferred. But yeah, exactly.
You know? It always seems to go back to Hayek. I find myself constantly referring people to Hayek's knowledge problem, because greenbackers, they point out, yes, the Fed does a poor job, you know, for its stated goals. I mean, its real goals, it's doing a great job, and it does a fraudulent job. You know, it steals money from the American people through inflation, which greenbackers don't seem to realize that their scheme will do that too. But they seem to think that Congress, this small group of individuals, that they're going to know what the correct supply of money is to be and what the correct type of money is to be, and whether the supply of money should be contracted or expanded or kept the same. And, you know, I want to ask them, where did they get the knowledge to be able to perform these calculations? I mean, tell me.
Well, you know, it's just simple. All I have to do is use multivariable calculus and plug some numbers in, find out how many consumers bought, you know, dog sweaters and Chevy Volts last year. And once you put that into equation, you can, and however many houses they have, you can put that in equation, you know, create as many variables as you want to, run regression on it and, you know, put it through an artificial neural network, and you come out with the optimal money supply.
Yeah, of course. And it's, you know, simple. If anyone couldn't tell, Drew was being sarcastic, because, of course, as we know from Hayek, that not only do they not know what this correct supply of Chevy Volts or bananas is going to be, it's impossible for them to know any such thing and to proclaim that they do. The laws of reality and reality economics that we talk about on this show tells us that it is impossible for anything but the free and unhampered exchange of individuals in the marketplace to bring about prices. And that includes the price and the supply of money. And I think you can make the argument that because money is the lifeblood of the economy, it's on one half of every exchange, that money is arguably the most important thing to be kept free of institutionalized intervention.
Well, yeah, and whenever you have the government deciding, like, this is going to be, you know, what the supply of money is, then you're basically creating a situation of price fixing. Now, I mean, you can obviously contrast that with some sort of a gold standard. But even with a gold standard, I mean, there's no fixed supply of gold. I mean, there is a fixed supply of gold overall, but there is not a fixed supply of gold in an economy. And that's kind of like, if you go back to like what they had in the prior to the Federal Reserve, you had like a roughly traded for like $20.50 per ounce of gold. And so, but it's not like, you know, that's not the trade. That's the definition. Like 1 ounce of gold is, It's just a definition. It's not fixing. It's like saying that a pound, like it's like saying that you're fixing 16 ounces is 1 pound. No, it's a definition.
Yeah, and of course that's, you know, gold standard gets thrown around, and you know, some libertarians or self-proclaimed libertarians talk about the gold standard, which is of course not exactly what I advocate, and I don't think Drew advocates as well. We advocate a free market system where we tend to believe that if we had an unhampered free market, we tend to believe that gold and silver would probably come back into use as the medium of exchange. But we're not saying that we want any law to force people to accept those, you know, silver or gold in exchange. And you know, Drew, I was the one thing I was, you know, because I want to connect with Greenbackers, I really do. You know, as stubborn as they are, but I think if we could teach them the business cycle theory, then that would really make a big impression. Because once you know the business cycle, you know any amount of money printing that's, you know, unbacked by specie is going to cause, it's going to cause interest rates to fall, and you're going to trigger the boom bust cycle.
I think you're stubborn, Aaron.
I'm it's just a stubborn advocate of freedom. What can I say?
Well, no, I mean, there's a valid point, but the thing is, you know, obviously, I think the convolution come, or what really the bottom line is between, you know, people that are, you know, like more interested in, you know, freedom versus the Greenbackers is that they still have this notion, and we kind of, you know, touched on it before, but they still have this notion that the institution of government is perfect. Well, it can be perfect, that, you know, despite the fact that, you know, however many ideas have failed in the past, it still can work. It just, it's an idea that, this idea that, you know, despite, that if you have good intentions, it doesn't matter the results. Because in a lot of people's mind that, you know, put their faith in the statist mindset is that good intentions lead to good results. Good intentions always lead to good results, and so therefore, then any edict, obviously, it's perfect. It's just that something else that could not have been foreseen screwed it up, and so therefore, then you need to continue to further intervene and change that.
And you know, some people, you can just by talking to them, you can kind of tell that they don't even really fully believe that, but it's the idea that if we can just hammer this one policy through, at least we can see if it works, or you know, that at least we have a plan. At least we're going somewhere, even if that plan is going to lead us to destruction. But if we could get Greenbackers to understand the Austrian business cycle theory and understand that money printing by any institution, doesn't matter if it's the Fed or the Treasury or a private bank, if you have credit expansion and money expansion of the money supply by any institution, that's going to cause malinvestment. It's going to trigger an unsustainable boom. Do you think that would force them to rethink their view?
Well, you know, there's several different ways to go about this. There's, you know, you can talk to them from an empirical point of view. You can say, look, all right, so you're interested in greenbacks. You're interested in some sort of government currency. The two most prominent examples of greenback or Greenbackerism are, number one, the Civil War, when we, like we pointed out earlier, was led to a price inflation of 75%. Or you can also look at Nazi Germany, which is Ellen Brown, another one of Ellen Brown's examples, where there was no consumer economy to speak of. All it was money was being funneled to build the war economy. So, and that's similar too in the American Civil War as well. So you're looking at it from an empirical point of view. You're looking at the people being impoverished through inflation and war spending, and destruction through war.
But then you know,
go ahead.
Sorry. Well, you know, Ed, I wanted to just interject, really, not interject. I want you to keep going with your thought, but just to remind our listeners that Greenbackers claim to be the you know, that this treasury control of the money is going to help the common man. When I want to remind our listeners that it is inflation of any kind that leads redistribution from the poor. It impoverishes the poor and the middle class and gives money to the elite. So it doesn't matter if the inflation is caused by the central bank or the treasury, because the treasury gets the money first, and the people who are politically well connected to the treasury get the money second. And so those two groups benefit at the expense of the poor. So it's silly for Greenbackers to say that this monetary scheme is going to help the common man. It's completely ridiculous. It's just not true.
And right. And you know, the thing is, so like just a second ago, I talked about the idea of, like, you know, an empirical analysis, and that's really not necessarily, you can't always say that, you know, because X happened, therefore then Y happened. There's obviously extraneous variables, but, you know, in the two major cases that the Greenbackers put forward, both of them have been tied to war, and they've been tied to impoverishing the people through destruction of war. But, you know, if you want to make more of a, I guess, a more of a priori case, is this idea that, typically you obviously cannot predict what's going to happen. And so there's no, going back to the knowledge problem, going back to this idea of the economic calculation problem, there's no way for the government, if it's going to be either through the central bank or through the treasury or through Congress or through, I don't know, oracles, slicing open oxen.
Magic fruit. Yeah, I don't know.
Slicing over oxen over fire or something. There's no way for them to know exactly how much money needs to be in the economy because it always fluctuates.
I think Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth, it's such a small book. That's one book that really needs to be mass produced. It just really does. And, you know, I wanted to talk to you because I know that you're a finance guy more so than I am. And one claim of Greenbackers is, of course, you know, the interest-free money printing is such a wonderful thing because it will allow us to pay for our debts with devalued money. And we've already discussed how inflation redistributes, wealth from the poor and the middle class to the elites. But in terms of the functioning market economy and in terms of how the inflation affects the relationship between debtors and creditors, who in their right mind would be a creditor, a lender in this type of system? And if the government's going to be the lender, how long can it keep the system up without destroying the currency?
Well, inevitably, I mean, inevitably they're not folk, like there's a for listeners not too familiar, there's a school of economic thought called public choice economics, whereby it talks about the rational self-interest of people in government, and the rational self-interest of people in government is to keep spending as much as possible and not raise taxes. And the thing is that these greenbackers, they just do not, like when you talk about fixing the debt situation, they just don't, despite the fact that they say, great, no longer will the government have to pay interest in order to issue money. They, like, if they're talking about finishing up and getting rid of the debt, they're not closing the hole on this idea of rational self-interest of people in government to keep on deficit spending. Because, in fact, since they're no longer going to have to pay interest, that's going to be an encouragement for them to have to spend more money. Are you following what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, and the other thing, you know, I was wondering, I mean, because I was thinking of this, and it's obvious to me, but I'm having a hard time articulating to our listeners that if lenders don't have an incentive to lend, if the paper money just keeps being, you know, debauched and manipulated, then, you know, the relationship between lenders and creditors is very important to capitalism. I mean, creditors supply the money so that entrepreneurs don't have to wait years building up their savings so they can embark on projects. You know, it's the interest that greenbackers so hate. I mean, they hate all kinds of interest, I'm sure, just like a lot of people do, that interest is inherently evil. Interest is a very important price, and if the government has control of it, that price is, just like every other price that the government touches, just going to be completely worthless.
Right. Well, and, you know, there's no way to say that, there's no way to know that they're going to be creating money at the correct level, and when they are creating money in order to pay for these deficits, there's nothing to stop them. I mean, at least with interest rates, it at least tries to act as a mechanism on the government to restrain spending. Now, currently in the United States, interest rates are low, so it's really easy for the United States. Rates on treasuries are really low right now, so it's really easy for the United States government to borrow. But say, for example, Greece, where their treasury bills are really, really high, it's impossible for them to borrow. It's impossible for them to borrow because nobody wants to lend to them because they think they're going to be, you know, defaulting, which they recently read is pretty darn close, probably maybe March or so. But this idea that, you know, you can't, like, they can, you know, accurately forecast the correct amount of deficit and the correct amount of money to print, it just boggles my mind.
Yeah, and as we, I'm sure every radio free market host recommends this every show, but I'm going to recommend it again. read, go to Google, and type in economic calculation in the socialist commonwealth. It's one of the shortest, most eye-opening, the explanatory power and how it's just such an enlightening book. It's very small. We were talking a little bit earlier about gold and silver, and it's just a kind of a reflex argument that greenbackers make. No. can't have silver or gold as money. There isn't enough of it. And it's just such a basic and silly objection that I wish, every one of these people who claims to know economics would just, read Rothbard a little bit. It's no crime to be, if you don't know anything about economics, it's okay. But it's irresponsible to have a loud opinion while not knowing about it. So in the short time that we have left, hopefully we can get this in, please, let's explain to our audience why it's complete hogwash to say that there isn't enough gold and silver to facilitate trade.
Well, prices adjust. Like you mentioned earlier in the show, money is one half of every transaction. On one half of the transaction, there's the good. On the other half of the transaction, there's the medium of exchange, which in our current indirect exchange economy is money. So, if there's not enough money to go circulate around, then necessarily the price of money becomes more dear for people, and the value of money in people's minds becomes more dear, and as a result, it becomes a higher price. So the price of goods then falls.
And we're getting close to the end of this break, but we're going to come back a little bit and talk a little more about this, because this is just a constant argument that greenbackers make, and we've got to really shut it down right here and now. So please stick with me, Aaron Brown, and Drew Yelm. We're on Radio Free Market. Stay with us. We're talking about greenbackism.
And welcome back to our last segment here on Radio Free Market. I'm your guest host, Drew Yelm, and along with me is Aaron Brown, and we are grappling with greenbackers. So before a break, we were talking a little bit about, I guess, the exchange economics behind gold and silver and commodity-based currencies, and the idea that greenbacks say that there's not enough gold or silver in the economy to have that as a money supply. What exactly can we say to that?
I wish greenbacks would just read Rothbard and just kind of then we can get onto a real argument, which is who is to say what is enough or not enough? No one ever asks whether what the correct supply of Fruit Loops is today. No one asks about what the correct supply of fuzzy socks is. On the free market, goods come into existence when there's a demand for it. I want to flesh this out just really briefly. On the free market, let's say silver was kind of organically chosen as the money because that is how money comes into existence. It comes into existence organically. If consumers demanded more silver coins, then minting costs would go up because they have, they have more business, margin utility. The minting costs would go up. Silver would go up in price as it kept being consumed for money. As the price of silver went up and the price of minting went up, then consumers would have an incentive to demand less silver because it's more expensive to make it into coins. So just to say there isn't enough gold or silver and say it like this is just very matter of fact, it's just garbage economics. It's a silly myth that we need to get rid of, that because so many people fall into it, that there's just not enough gold.
Well, that's not even just the greenbackers too. That's like
it's everyone. You're right.
That's the standard neoclassical fusion. We need the Federal Reserve. We need 3-4% inflation per year because
money needs to expand with the needs of trade. I hear this all the time. Money needs to expand with the needs of trade. Whatever that means. How do these people profess to know that? 3-4% inflation, this is right. Why not 20-30?
But I guess, we're getting pretty close to the end of the show here, but, I think it's really weird that, what these greenbackers are trying to say is that they can, get rid of the power of the elites with their system.
Yeah, that's the irony when we talk to people about these problems. Unless you understand Austrian economics and you understand the nature of the state and the knowledge problem and all these things we've been talking about, unless you have this kind of nuanced, educated view, all of these schemes are not going to get rid of the elite that the greenbackers profess to hate. They're going to make them more entrenched. They're going to make them more powerful. And then at the very least, they're certainly not going to hurt them. I mean, the moneyed elite are going to, they're going to benefit from the system because they are the politically well connected. And it's not just the government that benefits from the central banking scheme, it's the banks. And the banks are going to, you know, either way, they're going to benefit in the system. It's the state that we need to focus on, not the bankers.
Right. And that's, I mean, you summed it up pretty nicely there. It's the state, not the bankers.
Yeah. I think just all that is really needed is an understanding of where money comes from, right? What has government done to our money? Another book that needs to be just mass produced. When you understand that money is just, it's an organic thing. It just comes about.
Even if you want to talk about greenbackers, we're coming up at the end of the show here, but, I really thank Aaron for being with us today. And he brought up Gary North earlier in the show. And if you want to really just get a fundamental basis of why this whole idea of greenbackerism is wrong, you could look at any one of the dozens of articles that Gary North has put together just deconstructing greenbackerism.
Yeah. So this is Drew Elm and Aaron Brown. We want to thank you for being with us today on Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can subscribe for free to all of our shows on iTunes, or visit our Radio Free Market archives for easy download. And until next week, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.